I may or may not pronounce Teir de Chardin as well as Tom did. His first name, by the way, not Tom's, but Teir's, is Pierre. If you go looking for his books, don't look under Chardin, although sometimes he's misfiled that way. His last name is Teir de Chardin. You know, the de something that is often used as family name, ancestry in parts of Europe. So it's Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. When I finished my PhD dissertation and was doing the oral exams, my committee, headed by Ramon Panikkar, main teacher in my life, also included Walter Capps and Jerry Larson. And at that exam, I remember making the statement that even though Teilhard was not as visible anymore, this was in the early 1980s, there was a Teilhard movement during the 1970s. He was really all over the place for a while. And by the time the early 80s came, that the movement had kind of dissipated. But I made the statement in my oral exams that Teilhard's influence was still important. And I remember Walter Capps challenging me, well, where is the evidence for that? At the time, I couldn't give a whole lot. But I wish Walter were still alive today, for many reasons, but including so I could say, see? If you haven't seen this book by Carter Phipps, it's called Evolutionaries. There's a lot of working and writing going on these days in the areas of evolutionary enlightenment, and, as you're familiar with from having the book last semester, in integral studies. And in this book, Carter Phipps talks about a large number of the major figures who are working in those areas. And I think without exception, every single one of them mentions Teir de Chardin as a prime influence on their thought and vision. So Walter, wherever you are, I was right at least about that. What I'm going to do today, I may need to beg your indulgence. I've tried to get this as short as I can to make it fit in the usual allotted time, and I think I'm going to succeed. But just in case, if I do run over the usual break time, please indulge me. I would prefer not to break the presentation once we start. John Philip Newell, citing Carl Jung, talked about moon-like mind and sun-like mind. We're going to have some of both today. We'll begin with moon-like mind, the kind of mind which is more like the mystical mind where everything is, you experience the oneness. Then we're going to go into the sun-like mind for quite a while with Teilhard, covering a mere 14.5 billion years of evolution. And during that part, I encourage you to even experience that with moon-like mind, that there's quite a bit of detail. I left out as much as I could to make it short, but I didn't want to leave out so much that I would misrepresent Teilhard. So during that part, if you can, just kind of absorb the sweep of it. It's profusely illustrated. The illustrations that you're going to see this morning were developed by several men in the Phenomenon of Man project back in the 1970s. That organization included a few artists who worked in advertising, and it included some scientists. And it was they were so inspired by Teilhard's work that they started this nonprofit corporation of which I eventually became a member. And they developed over 600 color slides. Back in those days, it was color slides, no PowerPoint. They developed 600 color slides and developed a six-hour lecture presenting Teilhard's thought. This is going to be much shorter than that. I have presented this to myself three times now, trying to shorten it as I go, as much as I can. So if I could listen to myself three times, I hope you can listen to me once, even if I go over. I'd like to begin with a little bit of moon-like mind by doing together, please, a prayer, which is in the spirit of Teir de Chardin. There it is. If you'll join me. O God, creator of the universe, sustainer of all, we offer our prayers of thanksgiving for my birth in a world that fills me with wonder, for the beauties of earth, for each breath that I breathe. Thanks be to you, O my God. For the plants whose gifts feed my body, for the flowers that awaken my heart. Thanks be to you, O my God. for the spiraling arms of our galaxy home, for the arms that embrace me in friendship or love. Thanks be to you, O my God, for the most distant star in infinity space, for the innermost flow of my thoughts. Thanks be to you, O my God, for the ongoing power of creation itself, for my ability here, now, to pray. Thanks be to you, O my God, for each moment of silence as I rest in your grace. Thanks be to you, O my God. You ever looked on the back of a quarter? Above the eagle is this wonderful American motto, E pluribus unum, out of many, one. What a great motto. We're going to be going through three phases today, quite quickly. And in order to get this grammatically correct, I consulted with my brother, who's a Catholic priest in Tucson, my brother, Father Bob. He's the family Latin expert. So, at the beginning, there was a singularity after the Big Bang. So, ex uno, plures, out of one, many. And then we have a long, long period of cosmic evolution, e pluribus plurissima, out of many, really, really many. And then, now, hopefully, we pray, e pluribus unum. By the way, I don't usually wear a scarf. This is my John Philip Newell costume. This is Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. And this is probably his best known quotation, one of my very favorites. The day will come when, after harnessing space, the winds, the tides, and gravitation, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And on that day, for the second time in the history of the world, we will have discovered fire. Now comes the sun-like mind part, but please relax into it. These slides will go fairly fast, and I'm going to do my best to not go too far over the usual break time. John Philip Newell asks, in his New Harmony book, what are the older unities we are being invited to rediscover in our lives and our world? And what are the boundaries we are to cross for the sake of healing today? Boundaries between our nations and religions that before have seemed so absolute. We'll try to approach at least the beginnings of an answer to that important question. Teilhard de Chardin's masterwork, The Human Phenomenon, originally translated as The Phenomenon of Man before the women's movement woke us up to proper language. The right name of the book is The Human Phenomenon. In fact, that's what it is in French. The book focuses on one subject, humanity. Humanity as situated in an evolving universe. Teilhard traces our evolution through four major eras of cosmic time and cosmogenesis. First, pre-life. The universe and our planet Earth as it existed before the appearance of life. Second, life. The development of the first simple cells, and then simple forms of life, up to more complex forms. And then humanity makes its appearance, and the era of thought is born. And finally, the future, the fourth part of Teilhard's book, of that particular book. Do we reach the present after billions of years of cosmic evolution and suddenly stop evolving? Or if evolution continues, what does the future hold? Is there a future? In this presentation, the building blocks of cosmic evolution are represented by simple geometrical symbols representing the levels from subatomic particles, little triangle here, from subatomic particles through atoms, molecules, megamolecules, and cells, and up to the human. The magenta dots within the symbols represent the within, or consciousness. Much more about that as we go along. The black curve, the bottom curve there, represents the increasing physical complexity of the universe through the course of cosmic evolution. The parallel magenta curve represents the increasing complexity of the within. And for Teilhard, Teilhard insisted that the within, or consciousness, is a dimension of evolution that is fully as real as the increase of physical complexity. That theme has been picked up especially by folks like the integral thinkers these days, but they're not alone in that by any means. In its most elemental form, matter reveals three characteristics: plurality, unity, and energy. The plurality of the universe is apparent in everyday experience, in raindrops, in grains of sand, in the multitude of stars. And yet, as we analyze matter into smaller and smaller particles, we also inevitably find a fundamental unity. There's no such thing as a single particle existing alone, all by itself. Each particle, in a way, touches and is involved in the whole cosmos, and each particle's unique characteristics are defined by its interrelationships within this whole. It's this capacity for interrelationship that marks the third phase of the universe, energy. And of course, since Einstein, we know that energy and matter are different expressions of the same thing, expressions of each other. And so it's impossible to break off any fragment of the universe and study it in isolation from the rest, even though that's still sometimes the route that science takes. You try to take one thing and study it all by itself. You can't, not ultimately, not really. All matter is in a constant state of genesis. Nothing is static. As Teilhard puts it, the universe is in, or rather, the universe is a mass in transformation, giving rise to ever higher forms. Over the beginning of cosmic time, subatomic particles are collected together, packed in, until there was a change of state, and the world of the atom was born. So that's a major transformation. The ongoing process of matter evolving into higher and higher states is constrained by two fundamental laws of classical physics. First, the conservation of energy. The energy required and consumed for any synthesis or transformation can never come from somewhere outside the universe, but only from within the universe. Second, the dissipation of energy, or entropy. In every physical or chemical change, some quantity of the available energy in the universe is dispersed, rendered no longer available for any further use. Taken together, these two principles seem to tell us that all the structures that have arisen through synthesis and evolution, including ourselves, are doomed to fall back. Entropy seems to say that all of this is doomed to fall back into the dispersed state from which they came. Entropy seems to say that there must come a time when the whole cosmos will level out to a uniform temperature and no activity of any kind can happen after that. But Teilhard insists that this picture is radically incomplete and is a result of our looking at the universe and evolution only in terms of physical matter and energy, the dimension that Teilhard calls the without. But the universe, he says, has an inner aspect that is as deeply fundamental as the physical. Teilhard calls this, as you might guess, the within. If a materialist looks at terrestrial evolution, it's seen as a process only of increasing physical complexity. But Teilhard says this is only a partial view. What we really see before us, he says, is a process of increasing complexity, consciousness. Possibly a physicist and a geologist might be able to do their work while ignoring or not even seeing anything that they might call consciousness. In fact, materialist science deliberately defines out consciousness as a working hypothesis. But the biologist and the biophysicist and the microbiologist, working on the borders between matter and life, have to wonder about the spontaneity exhibited by even the most primitive virus and bacteria. The within becomes increasingly hard to ignore for those who study the behavior of plants, insects, and animals. And finally, in the human, it's impossible to deny the within. Each of us directly experiences a within, and even the act of denying consciousness is an act of consciousness. That's my favorite koan. If I hear some, I do, in conversations, hear somebody denying that there's any such thing as mind or consciousness, and I always have to ask myself, and I'm always tempted to ask out loud, why should I pay attention to anything you're saying? You're telling me it's all a matter of random firings in your brain. Why should I pay attention to you? Open question. For Teilhard, it makes no sense to assume that a within suddenly sprang into existence out of nowhere as a mere side effect of the physical complexity of the brain. Instead, he says, it makes much more sense, and it's much more in keeping with the consistency of the universe, to recognize that the within is a dimension of all of reality. The way that Ken Wilber and other integralists put it, it goes all the way up and all the way down. For Teilhard, the term the within, or consciousness, means any and every kind of interiority, from the most rudimentary imaginable form of interiority through the complex phenomenon of reflective thought that we experience in ourselves. So the within, when he's saying the within is a dimension of all matter, he doesn't mean that atoms sit and think, for example, but that as a dimension of reality, the within goes all the way up, all the way down. He didn't use that phrase. To understand energy in relation to the within and the without, Teilhard posits two distinct components to energy. First, tangential energy. This is the external aspect of energy, the aspect studied by physics. Tangential energy links element to element on the same level of complexity. Tangential energy causes elements to grasp, or rather to group together, to interact, to affect one another in terms of physical laws. But physical interactions, says Teilhard, are only one piece of the puzzle. Cosmogenesis also involves synthesis, transformation, changes of state. Teilhard uses the term radial energy for the component of energy that links elements center to center in a way that draws them not only to interact, but to undergo changes of state toward ever greater complexity and consciousness. That obviously is going to have big implications for our level of complexity when we get there. I mean, we're already there, but when we get there in this presentation. Gravity is an example of tangential energy. In the earliest stages of cosmic evolution, subatomic particles are drawn together by their tangential energy to interact with other particles. Gradually, physical conditions reach a kind of threshold state, and then, under the influence of the radial component of energy, the particles enter into a process of transformation. And with a sudden change of state, a new form of reality appears, the atom. The same process repeats on successive levels of complexity consciousness, gradually giving rise to the first living cells. And with the cell, there's a tremendous increase of the within. Teilhard rejects the dualism of modern Western thought, which claims that matter and consciousness are completely separate from one another. Instead, he insists that the rise toward greater complexity involves matter and consciousness, the within and the without. When we take the within into account, Teilhard says, evolution tells us that the universe will not find its stability and final end in its decomposition, as the laws of entropy seem to imply. But if the universe holds together at all, it's from above. Something, he says, is drawing our universe not only toward ever greater complexity, but also toward ever greater consciousness. John Philip Newell, on page 142 of our book, says, life is not composed simply of its material elements. Its quintessence is the longing for relationship and for new beginnings, unquote. At the very beginning of terrestrial evolution, a great mass of matter stabilized at just the right distance from the mother star to receive moderate radiation. This mass begins to roll in upon itself to take shape. At first, it's only a molten metallic sphere in which there's only the simplest forms of dissociated matter. This is the barosphere. The surface of the barosphere over cosmic time cools to form a thin, rocky skin, the lithosphere. There's further cooling and the emergence of the hydrosphere, the fluid layers of the Earth in which water, ammonia, and carbon dioxide gradually combine, forming ever larger and more complex combinations. Something is about to break out on the early Earth. And there's something is life. The natural granule of the world of physics is the atom, life has its counterpart. The natural granule of the world of biology is the cell, the building block of life as we know it. And so we see the elemental stuff of the universe transformed into atoms through immense durations into molecules, organic molecules, finally into cells. Life, as we know it, finally appears. Millions of forms jostling, shoving one another, competing for space and resources, survival of the fittest through natural selection. Nature seems to try everything, to experiment with all possibilities, constantly groping toward new forms as a solution to survival. Teilhard states emphatically that it's a mistake to see this movement as mere random chance. This groping, this experimentation, this trial and error, he says, have an underlying direction. Now, plurality is certainly evident as life begins its ascent on Earth, but to see life properly, you must never lose sight of the global unity that embraces the overwhelming multitudes of all things. With its first appearance, life branches, it ramifies, it arranges itself into natural living bundles, such as classes, orders, families, genera, species. The complexity of the tree of life has increased greatly since Teilhard's own time. In the slide that we used to use, there were only like three branches on the tree of life. So the science has changed quite a bit. You don't have to look at these details on this slide, but this represents more of what the tree looks like as understood today. Despite the change in the details of the tree of life, though, I'm pretty convinced that Teilhard's main thrust and vision hold true, as we'll see right now. Evolution continues today on many, if not all, branches of the tree. This is another depiction of the tree with the poodle at the top. For example, we're only too familiar today with how bacteria and viruses continue to evolve, often outpacing our attempts to control them. Some scientists define evolutionary success only in terms of the number of individuals that survive in any given species. On that basis, certainly bacteria and insects would have to count as among the most successful examples of evolution. But recall that for Teilhard, the key to understanding evolution is the law of complexity consciousness. In order to understand evolutionary progress, we must follow the lines where there is the most concentrated advance of complexity consciousness. That draws our attention to the vertebrate branch. The vertebrate branch evolved through stages, and eventually on this branch, there appears a new stem leading to the mammal world. And at the very top of that stem, a tiny lobe will appear, a recent offshoot on the tree of life. In that lobe, we finally make our appearance on the scene some 2 to 3 million years ago, perhaps longer according to contemporary paleontology. In any case, a split second in evolutionary time. And to the most recent shoot on that branch, the primates, belongs the honor of bridging the eras of life and thought, the furthest extension of consciousness so far. Why the primates? Because in them, evolution went straight to work on the brain, almost ignoring everything else. Quoting directly from Teilhard, quote, in one well-marked region at the heart of the mammals, where the most powerful brains ever made by nature are to be found, they become red hot. And right at the heart of that glow burns a point of incandescence. Still quoting. We must not, he says, we must not lose sight of that line crimsoned by the dawn. After millions of years rising below the horizon, a flame bursts forth. Thought is born. The primate becomes reflective. My favorite movie of all time was The Space Odyssey. I've seen it 25 times, literally. And there's a moment there where shortly after the first appearance of that monolith, there's a proto-human ape crouching and cocks his head in kind of the... It's a really nice depiction of this particular moment. Cocks his head. Thought is born. Reflective consciousness starts to happen. From branch to branch, the psychical temperature of the cellular world had been rising for more than 500 million years. Finally, with the primates, the psychical makeups reached the borders of intelligence,
across the borders.
Teilhard offers a simple analogy to help envision what happens when there's a change of state. When water is brought to the boiling point and more heat is added, what happens next, without further change in the temperature of the water, what happens next is a sudden change of state, a transformation. Water becomes steam. The buildup of the temperature toward 212 degrees Fahrenheit may have taken a long time, but at that moment where it reaches the boiling point, it's as if everything happens all of a sudden. Long buildup, and then all of a sudden, a change of state. Similarly, says Teilhard, when the primate had been brought mentally to the boiling point, some further energy was added. Outwardly, almost nothing in the organs has changed, and yet in depth, a profound revolution has taken place. By a tiny tangential or physical increase in the complexity of the brain, the radial energy was concentrated in upon itself and took an infinite leap forward. From the cell to the atom, or rather from the cell to the human, as from the atom to the cell, evolution's broad strokes define one consistent process, the constant increase of the within. After the atom, the cell. Now we have it. Now we have the human person. These, then, are the building blocks of the universe as we know it today. Humankind slowly becomes outlined and linked up, slowly encompassing the sphere we call the Earth. Slender and granular as that first membrane may have been, a sphere of thought began to close in upon itself and to encircle the Earth. We saw how the planet Earth was first a molten barysphere, followed by a rocky lithosphere, then the hydrosphere and the atmosphere, and within that envelope, the biosphere, the sphere of life, emerged. From this envelope, from the biosphere and in the biosphere, a glow ripples outward from the first sparks of conscious reflection. The points of ignition grow larger. The fire spreads in ever-widening circles, until finally the whole planet is covered with incandescence. This is a new layer, the thinking layer. Teilhard offers a name for this grand phenomenon. A few others at the same time coined the same word. The word that he uses is the noosphere. And so we add another planetary layer, an envelope of thinking substance. With the emergence of the noosphere, the Earth gets a new skin. Better still, says Teilhard, the Earth finds its soul. We are, during our evolutionary moment, passing through a change of age. Life is taking a decisive step in us and in our environment. After many centuries, the hour has finally come, characterized by the inevitable birth pangs of another change of state. That's one piece of Teilhard where I take kind of cold comfort when I watch the horrible things on the news every night. He notes that as we come closer and closer to each other and are approaching another change of state, it's inevitable that there's going to be these birth pangs. And we're even going to try to repel each other with all our might. And because he's so correct about us repelling each other with all our might, I take comfort in that maybe that means some of the rest of what he saw is also accurate. Cold comfort, but comfort. To us, in the span of a few brief generations, to us falls the honor and good fortune of coinciding with the critical transformation of the noosphere. Barbara Marks Hubbard, who is our speaker a few weeks ago in this series, this is a quote from one of her books. We, she says, we are the generation born in the midst of the end of one phase of human evolution and the beginning of another. Let's try to understand the form of consciousness that's coming to birth in the womb of the Earth today. To discover our place in the cosmos, we have had to gradually acquire a whole series of new senses. Less than 500 years ago, we conceived of the Earth as flat and the universe the heavens as a vast ceiling above us with holes poked through for the stars. Gradually, we became aware that we did not live on a flat surface, but on a sphere. Still, we didn't fully understand, for we imagined this earth we lived on to be the center of the universe, with everything in the heavens revolving around us. For challenging that view, some people gave their lives. Galileo comes to mind, who was not killed for it, but was threatened with death. But with the coming of Copernicus, Galileo, and others, this ancient geocentric view was exploded, and we discovered an unlimited cosmos. Through the invention of the telescope, our awareness of spatial immensity becomes possible. And so we kick out one wall of our tight little world. And to balance it, the infinitesimal springs into view through the lens of the microscope. After the walls of space, it's the floor of time that was next to give. Through the gradual discovery of evolution, we slowly became aware of the measureless abysses of the past. And through our awareness of the future, the ceiling of time likewise expands. And yet in these first stages of our awakening to the immensities of the cosmos, space and time, however vast, are conceived as two great containers separate from each other. It was only late in the 19th century, through the discoveries of evolution and relativity, that the light dawned at last. All objects are born from their growing together from a common beginning. All things are related to each other through space and through time. Space and time are organically joined again to weave together the stuff of the universe. The landscape lights up and yields its secrets. The very act by which our minds penetrate the absolute is a phenomenon of emergence. So as I was preparing this, it occurred to me that that single sentence could provide fodder for a really, really long, interesting discussion. The very act by which our minds penetrate the absolute is a phenomenon of emergence, and you might say cosmic emergence. For we are evolution. We are not the center of the universe, as once we thought in our simplicity. We're something much more wonderful. We're the arrow pointing the way toward the unification of the world in terms of life and consciousness. Now, it's impossible to find oneself in a completely new environment without experiencing the terrors of a metamorphosis. When we first emerge from our dark prison, we're awed to find ourselves suddenly at the top of a pyramid. We're dazzled and confused. We suffer from giddiness and disorientation. As humanity awakens to the vastness of time and space, we are today more uneasy, and our sense of anxiety is more widely experienced than ever before in human history. And today, especially because of technology and population growth, we're packed together, literally in each other's faces, much more obviously than at any other time in history. One response to these terrors and pressures of modernity is to try to force us back into the dimensions of the 18th century, renouncing almost everything we discovered, grasping for a sense of absolute certainty, predictability, and control. That's one possible response. But for those who have awakened to the grandeur of the universe, renouncing our knowledge and discoveries would mean a deliberate closing over of our sense of the future. Teilhard puts it this way: either nature is closed to our demands for a future, in which case reflective thought, the fruit of billions of years of effort, is stifled, stillborn, in an absurd universe, or an opening exists, an opening of something above our individual souls. What are the minimal requirements, Teilhard asks, what are the minimal requirements to be fulfilled before we can say that the way ahead of us is open? First, that there is for us in the future, under some form or another, not only the possibility of survival on Earth, but also of a superior form of existence. Secondly, to imagine, to discover, and reach this higher life. We have only to walk in the direction in which the lines of evolution take on their maximum coherence. In other words, where consciousness is at its greatest. To bring us into existence, the world has, from the beginning, juggled miraculously with too many improbabilities for there to be any risk whatever in committing ourselves further and following the process right to the end. I believe it was after Teilhard's time that, in connection with that comment about the universe juggling with too many improbabilities to bring us into existence, it's said now that at the moment of the Big Bang, had that initial temperature been something like a thousandth or less of a degree less, the universe would have, I might have this two ways backwards, the universe would have petered out, would never have given rise. If it had been something like a thousandth or less of a degree hotter at that very initial instant of the universe, if it had been just that much hotter, the universe would have blown up like a balloon and we never would have appeared. And so as a physicist, Freeman Dyson is often quoted as saying, it's as the beginning of the universe, at the beginning of the universe knew that we were coming and provided for us. So if the world undertook the task in the first place, it's because it can finish it following the same methods with which it began. We must come to realize that we carry the world's fortunes within ourselves and that a limitless future stretches before us. In the last analysis, the best guarantee we have that such a thing should happen is that it appears to us to be vitally necessary. That's another sentence that could take a long, interesting conversation because it sounds tautological first. Our best guarantee that it can happen is that we consider it to be vitally necessary. That seems like a baseless statement until we remember that Teilhard is insisting, as others do now, that we are evolution. So if we are that, then our own best guarantee that a future is possible is that we as evolution feel it as absolutely necessary. Have you ever wondered, Teilhard asks, what would have become of humanity if we had been free to spread out indefinitely on a limitless surface? Perhaps nothing at all would have happened when we think of the extreme importance of the forces of compression that are brought about by the spherical shape of the Earth, the limitation of a planet closed like a giant molecule upon itself. The limited surface of the Earth creates a pressure buildup as population densities increase. Under this pressure, the pressure of tangential and physical energy, under this pressure, the human elements infiltrate each other more and more. Our minds are mutually stimulated by proximity. Humankind, forced to develop in a confined area, has found itself subject to intense pressure. Gradually, this tangential pressure, this increasing physical pressure, causes the radial energies of consciousness to concentrate toward a sort of super consciousness. The final unification of our planet is the natural culmination of a cosmic process that has its roots in the history of the universe itself. But what exactly is humankind? We have existed on Earth some 2 or 3 million years or more, and yet in the course of only a few generations, all kinds of totally new economic and cultural links have been forged around and between us, and they continue to multiply at a rapidly increasing rate. The Earth is not only becoming covered by innumerable grains of thought, but it's becoming encased in a single grain of thought. Humankind is now forming a layer of thinking substance of planetary dimensions, a noosphere that develops and intertwines its fibers to reinforce all of us in the living unity, the original unity, our chapter, in the living unity of one single tissue. The noosphere begins to comprise a single closed system in which every thinking element experiences for itself the same thing as all others. Each of us experiencing the same thing as all others, does that automatically mean bliss, union, harmony? Obviously not. Side note, David Ray Griffin, who was a speaker here during the last semester, in a little seminar that Tom mentioned, David was talking about the word telepathy, and he points out that pathy is the same grammatical word as in empathy, empathy meaning feeling with someone. So telepathy, by the very nature of that word, doesn't mean that I'm experiencing your thoughts, that all the chatter that's going on in your head and mine are shared by each other. Telepathy is actually feeling each other at a distance. It makes a lot more sense. And in this context, that kind of experiencing the same thing together makes a lot more sense. We feel what's going on halfway around the world if we pay any attention at all to the media. And usually it hurts because of what the media chooses to focus on. We can feel what's going on with other people. And when we're all together, we can feel each other. You wouldn't want to be in the chatter of my mind. And I don't want other thoughts even making that more crowded than it already is in here. But I do want unity through spirit. I did. That was the tingle. Thank you. So if we all experience the same thing today, it's all too obvious that what we experience includes a staggering proportion of suffering and fear. But Teilhard insists that this is not the end of the story. The worst of our suffering is what we inflict upon ourselves, the violent results of our doctrines of domination and isolationism. But the natural outcome of the world, the entry into the superhuman, this is not open only to a privileged few, to the exclusion of all others. Rather, it will be open only to an advance of all together, in a direction in which all together can unite and find completion in a spiritual renewal of the earth. We can hope for no evolutionary future except in association with one another. John Philip Newell says in A New Harmony, he says he agrees with Teilhard, noting that the universe will be unified only through personal relationships. That's John Philip Newell, that's also Teilhard. So how are we going about unifying so far? Never before in history has humankind been so well equipped and exerted such efforts to reduce its multitudes to order. Millions are depersonalized into economic units, exploited as the tokens of the grand schemes of domination and conquest, manipulated by a constant barrage of fear, or simply ignored as insignificant cogs in a global machinery. In short, we're battered and deceived into 100 forms of false unity. False because they materialize rather than spiritualizing. False because they increase our isolation while pretending to unite us. And so we see that in our freedom to choose, we could very well make the wrong choice and put an end to our evolution. Our future is dependent, says Teilhard, upon the courage and resourcefulness of those who commit themselves to overcoming the forces of isolationism and repulsion that drive us apart. Forced together on the limited surface of our spherical planet, we can become truly unified only under the influence of some force of attraction that goes deeper than the surface forces of repulsion. Only by uniting can we progress. But this unity, this uniting, must be achieved through unanimity and not through coercion. Thus, the process must extend itself from simple reflective thought that is purely of the mind into a more complex form of thought, a sort of hyper-reflection. Teilhard asks, what is the result of human works if not to create in and through each of us a supremely original center in which the universe uniquely reflects itself? And these centers, our very selves, are true persons, resonance to and through and with one another? Are we not experiencing the preliminary symptoms of a still higher state, a deep harmony between two realities that seek each other? We have evolved from the stuff of the universe, but we've not yet completed our evolutionary process. We're moving toward a critical new point ahead. When we stop looking at the universe only in terms of physical laws, and when we take the within into account, we see that the layers of evolution naturally converge somewhere ahead in what Teilhard calls a point omega. Omega, says Teilhard, is a distinct center radiating to and through a series and a system of centers. The ultimate meaning of cosmogenesis is that space and time become truly humanized, or more correctly, superhumanized. In any true union, be it the cells of a body, partners in a relationship, members of a team, in any true union, union differentiates. It is the same, says Teilhard, in the case of individual grains of hyperconsciousness. Individual personalities do not lose their identities. They do not blend, like merging in the ocean of eternity, or dissolving like grains of thought. They do not. Instead, they accentuate the depth and the inviolability of their true selves. The closer they become to all the others in the process of uniting, the more they discover themselves as self. John Philip Newell in The New Harmony, you might remember the scene where he's talking about the wedding that he performs in the Abbey of John and Fran. John and Fran, says John Philip Newell, did not enter into union through a loss of individuality in this marriage. Quite the opposite. John and Fran were entering a union that was based on a deep cherishing of their distinctness as individuals. And John Philip Newell goes on to say, communion is not about absorption or loss of self. It's about finding ourselves in one another. The centers of consciousness are, as Teilhard puts it, steeped in omega, and can become wholly themselves only by super-centralizing themselves. The self must continually exist by abandoning itself, where the gift will fade away. But where has it been written that he who loses his soul shall save it? Each center becomes even more itself, more clearly distinct from all the others, the closer it gets to the others in omega. To envision this, to undergo it, and to make it act, that is to say, for reasons of survival, we must look beyond our individual souls toward the threshold that Teilhard calls the omega point. For a while in the most feverish part of the Teilhard movement, there was this thought that the omega point was kind of literally an instantaneous kind of point, and suddenly crossing that, everybody would wake up simultaneously at the same time. We'd all know each other. We'd all love each other. Ta 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 ta. I think it's much more something like when Kathy Collis spoke to us the other day. She talked about her dream, and she said in her dream she was looking back from the future at our time. And she saw, how'd she put it, she saw that our time was the beginning of the emergence of the undivided self, is the way she put it. And the beginning of that, we're still in evolutionary time. It's not an instantaneous everybody at once. It's one-on-one, group by group, however we can find each other. I think that's what the omega point really is. The omega point is not a tiny point. It's a stage evolution. We're in it. So to discover the key to our survival, it now becomes imperative that we identify and harness those energies of the noosphere that are of an intercentric nature, that is, center to center, soul to soul, and not just mind to mind. And this brings us to the problem of love, which Teilhard defines broadly as the affinity of being with being. Love, the affinity of being with being, he says, is not unique to humankind, because if there were no internal tendency to unite, even at a rudimentary level, if there were not this internal tendency to unite, love could never have appeared at a higher and conscious level within ourselves, because we would never have appeared. John Philip Newell says, quote, "Love is the gold at the heart of life's chrysalis, and it is not simply gold at the heart of the human chrysalis. Love is the desire for relation at the heart of the universe." Unquote from John Philip. We've spoken of radial energy as the force of attraction that drives the fragments of the universe to seek each other so that the world may come into being. Without love, or therefore, love defined... Sorry, going the wrong way. So Teilhard defines love as this internal tendency to unite. That's also how we define radial energy. Therefore, in Teilhard, love is radial energy, a key component of the energy of the universe. Without love, the future offers us nothing but standardization and exploitation. It's through love and within love that we must search for our deepest self in the life-giving coming together of humankind. This is another of Teilhard's most famous quotations. "Love is the free and imaginative outflowing of the spirit over all unexplored paths. It links those who love in bonds that unite but do not destroy. It causes them to discover in their mutual contact an exaltation capable of stirring all that they possess of uniqueness and creative energy. Love alone can unite living things so as to complete and fulfill them. For love alone joins us by what is deepest in ourselves. We must imagine our ability to love developing until it includes the totality of humankind and the earth. But is it not really impossible to love everything and everyone?" Teilhard insists that this is not as preposterous as it first seems. It is achievable, but only through a source of love that is higher and deeper than our individual ego selves. Quoting from John Philip Newell again in The New Harmony, he says, "We seek the one by seeking oneness with each other, by seeking to be in relationship with the rest of life, by living in relation to everything that has being. The tragedy of our reality," says John Philip, "is that we have fallen out of touch with this holy, natural longing." Holy spelled H-O-L-Y, but it works the other way too. Holy as in completely natural longing. End of quote. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. This is the greatest commandment. It comes first. But the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." Or to paraphrase, love each other, recognizing the same God who is both calling you forward and being born within each one of you. Humanity has extraordinary possibilities ahead of it. Since crossing the threshold of reflection, we have entered a completely new phase of terrestrial evolution. Thanks to the powerful capacity of reflective consciousness to gather together and combine into one conscious embrace of transformation, we are faced with a sort of collective exaltation, human vibrations resonating by the millions, an entire planetary layer of consciousness bringing pressure to bear simultaneously on the future and on a whole storehouse of some millions of years of thought. The noosphere, released at long last from its anguish of fragmentation, fulfilled at long last, will come to center itself with all its weight in God, Omega. Concluding this part now, John Philip again, page 146 of his book. John Philip Newell says, "This is what many of us are seeking today in the Christian household and in other spiritual traditions. To take precious fragments from the wreckage of what our religious traditions have often become and to create something new in the midst of humanity's growing earth awareness. Quoting again from John Philip Newell, our experiences of communion in life are glimpses into this original unity. These experiences of communion, are a rediscovery of what we most truly are, one. Still quoting John Philip Newell, whether it's our experience of gazing into the vast infinity of night skies or looking deep into the eyes of someone we love, it is the recognition of a oneness that we did not create, but that we have been gifted with. It is the rediscovery of a harmony that precedes us, the remembering of a unity that is deep in the body of the universe. I would like to have another 5 minutes and 20 seconds of moon mind now before we break. First, a little bit of irreverence here. I prefer now. Thank you for the indulgence. This is from Bizarro. This was in the newspaper last week. How are we ever going to evolve if you people keep pushing us back in the ocean? This 5 minutes, it's kind of a meditation, and in a way it's the same thing I'm just talking about. It's from my little book. It's from the bonus DVD that comes with the book. This book is available over there in case you like it. It's also available at your favorite bookstore, if your favorite bookstore happens to be either Chaucer's or Paradise Found. And it's available here for about $4 less than it would cost at the bookstore. So consider this a kind of, if you would, a meditation on that whole sweep that we've just seen and how we go about discovering it. A moment ago, when I looked in your eyes, what I saw when I looked took me quite by surprise. Because what I saw when I looked in your eyes, I saw you, well, of course, and the stars and the skies. I saw starlight and sunshine below and above. I saw atoms and planets on fire with love. I saw flowers and trees and animals too. And joined in the dance, I saw me, I saw you. You looked totally changed and exactly the same. Your lips were not moving. You were singing my name. I picked up the melody, singing along. Your name was the lyric. I was singing your song. Creation joined in, all alive in one place, with a new kind of music made of time and of space. There were links and connections that I'd never seen, infinite, intimate, and all in between. The connections went deeper than I had ever known. Apart or together, we're never alone.
All of these things took us both by surprise. A moment ago, when I looked in your eyes, and I felt a vibration as if some kind of line were conducting a current between your heart and mine. And you felt it too, I could tell by your face, in that time out of time, in that moment of grace. So we stood there forever a moment ago. Then I knew what to say, so I said it. Hello.
Hello.